Hi, this is Tanya Domi. Welcome to The Thought Project, recorded at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, fostering groundbreaking research and scholarship in the arts, social sciences, and sciences. In this space, we talk with faculty and doctoral students about the big thinking and big ideas generating cutting-edge research, informing New Yorkers and the world. Martin Ruck is a professor in the PhD programs in psychology and urban education at the Graduate Center, CUNY. His work examines the overall process of cognitive socialization at the intersection of race, ethnicity, and class in terms of children's and adolescents' thinking about human rights and intergroup exclusion. He is also the senior advisor to the president for diversity and inclusion at the Graduate Center and has served in this capacity since 2016. Welcome to the Thought Project, Professor Martin Ruck.
Thank you, Tanya. Although this does seem a little bit strange, but thank you.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure. I'm so glad that you're with us now at the Thought Project. This conversation is a difficult one, but let's just put it in its right context. During the past year in America, we have witnessed the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, among many others. And the protests that followed has driven the issues of race, racism, and white supremacy to the forefront of a national American conversation. Of course, these murders are sadly not recent crimes or tragedies. This has been going on as long as America has existed. The current, but soon to be outgoing president has also assisted in forcing a confrontation about race in America too. These issues have affected the academy and specifically the Graduate Center and the City University of New York. So this is a significant part of the landscape of America that at this moment holds out some new possibilities with the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris next month. But we know, nonetheless, there is much work to do. It's in this context that we get to have this conversation, Martin, with you as a professor in psychology and urban education, working on the issues of race and racism and social justice with young people, utilizing human rights. But you're also in a dual-hatted role at the Graduate Center now for almost 5 years as senior advisor to the president on diversity and inclusion. I just want to know how you have managed this schedule, mentored students, teach, and carry that out every day.
Yeah, when you said that dual-hatted, it's like, oh, I guess I've cut down. Because actually, at the same time when I was doing this, I was also acting director of ARDAC, kind of kept me busy. It's an amazing institute, and the programming that comes out of ARDAC is amazing. And fortunately, Dees Dempster does all the heavy lifting. I just take credit for the successes, but you know, there are other people doing that. So I don't feel like I'm doing this by myself. And it's just kind of what you do, right? You have to just be prepared to help carry water, and it's what you do. And at the Graduate Center, especially with faculty of color, you know, when we have meetings that pertain to issues of race, ethnicity, and the faculty of color, it's typically the usual suspects in terms of the faculty that are kind of willing to play a role and do this. So, you know, I don't think of this as doing anything out of the ordinary. And then I just reflect back to kind of what my father did when I was growing up, and my mother, and the, you know, he always had multiple jobs and just to help the family survive. So I figured that's what you do, right? This is just kind of common. And this is difficult work, but it's not the sort of hard work and labor that I saw him engaging in, right? And so right. My dad was a janitor, a custodian, and he had like four or five different jobs during the day. And then on the weekends, he would deliver dry cleaning to the Black communities in kind of rural Nova Scotia where I grew up. So you work to survive, right? And you kind of do, I'm kind of doing the same thing because you just work not so much to survive, but you work so that things will get done and you can help other people, whether it's mentoring students or right, being involved with diversity issues here at the Graduate Center.
So you've been teaching in these areas for a long time. You're widely published, and there's no question that your own personal experience and your knowledge would certainly inform teaching in your diversity work. And how do you consciously go about that in your day-to-day life?
No, I'm not sure it's conscious. I'm sure it's at the back of my consciousness, but it's just like, this isn't going to be, I'm sure this won't be a very exciting interview for anyone listening to this, because I'll just repeatedly say it's kind of what you have to do. So you don't think about, oh, consciously doing this. It's just helping move things forward, even if it's just a little bit, just helping to move things forward. And who else is going to do it if I'm not willing to do these things? Why would I expect other people to carry the water or do the heavy lifting? You know, that's one thing about being at the Graduate Center, is that people are willing to do things, to work beyond their teaching, beyond their coursework. They're willing to attend the meetings and, you know, help to make the Graduate Center a better place, which is kind of an ongoing thing. We're always kind of pushing to make the Graduate Center better, but it's not easy because this is a bureaucracy. CUNY is a bureaucracy. We know how difficult it is to change bureaucracies, right? So how can we make a little bit of effort, a little bit of lead way? And, you know, over the last few years, there hasn't been a lot of leadership at the president level at the Graduate Center. And when there has been, it hasn't been consistent, right? So now we have a new president and hopefully we can get traction. And I'm assured that, and I kind of know that she is genuine and wants to make a change and make a difference. But, you know, these things take time. So you just have to keep pushing. Maybe I sound naive at times, but I think you just have to keep any movement, you have to keep moving forward, right? And
right.
I kind of view these last few or 4 years as kind of a step back. And hopefully now we can begin to move forward once again, right? I remember when Obama was elected, and I was sitting home and watching this, and people talking about this being a post-racial America. I just kind of rolled my eyes.
Right.
And said, no, it's anything but that, and you're going to see it during
Absolutely.
The Obama presidency. And we saw it even magnified during the current president, during the Trump presidency.
What you say is true. I mean, I think it is. It's from one generation to another. We do the work and we push forward in the ways that we can contribute. I'm reminded of that. Because in this week, actually, it's the anniversary of Rosa Parks and the Montgomery school bus boycott. And we think about that. And it's one of those, you know, it was a major turning point that Black people organized and boycotted the buses and people walked for over a year to prove that this was on principle unacceptable. It's something to remember about where we stand and what was behind us and what pushes us forward, I believe.
Yeah, just to look back over time in terms of, you know, how far we've come. I think I once wrote an article, kind of the ending was, we've come so far, but we have much further to go. There's some value to look back, but also you have to keep looking forward, right? We can't
right.
be content with where we are.
Yes, what's the next horizon? So in that vein, in the following days and weeks that followed the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, former President Myskins, who was interim president, agreed when approached that we should launch this new diversity and inclusion initiative. And that was a new development in your role. And since then, there's been a series of meetings. And in the last week, recommendations were forwarded to President Garrell. What are your thoughts been about that project? And full disclosure to our listeners, I also participated in the Creating a Safe Space Committee. And so what are your thoughts about that right now, Martin?
When President Myskins approached me, I wasn't surprised. I mean, I'm the senior advisor to the president of the Graduate Center for Diversity and Inclusion.
Sure.
So it doesn't surprise me that he approached me. And then we kind of laid out what he had in mind, or just kind of said his thoughts. And then I kind of shared my thoughts with him in terms of what ways we might move forward and also take advantage of the president's advisory committee on diversity and inclusion. And in the statement that he released, he mentioned that, you know, I was named and that our committee was named. So, you know, I knew that there was work to be done. I guess what also drives me is the fear of failure. It's one thing to let yourself down and you don't get a paper published or you don't get a grant. It's another thing to let down your community, the Graduate Center, the faculty, the staff, and the graduate students. There are a lot of eyes looking at this. You want people to be part of this and you want people to say, okay, we're moving in the right direction, right? So there was a little bit of apprehension, but I was, you know, that didn't stop me from taking on the lead. And I knew I would be working with good people, but that we had a lot of work to do. Sometimes I need to see the end. I need to know how it's going to end, but it's like, you have to keep get moving. And one thing in this position that was interesting, I like to get stuff off my desk. And this isn't something, this project, however you refer to this, isn't something you can just get done and get off your desk.
Right.
Right. So being able to kind of be aware of that and not get too anxious that we're not moving fast enough. Because I think I might have even mentioned at some of our meetings, I don't know if it was a meeting, the working group that you were part of, that I didn't think we were moving fast enough. Right.
I don't recall that.
Right. No, but I think I mentioned that.
But you know, yeah, I understand the urgency too.
Yeah, and especially when you're
urgency.
Exactly. Especially when I'm chairing three different working groups. So I wanted to get some traction, right? And I wanted to come up with recommendations or something, like, because we, in theory, we could have met forever.
True. True. You know,
because many a times our discussions would be far ranging. So we had to kind of, how do we focus this and get something that we can present to the president and the senior staff? So I think we did a good job of coming up with recommendations, and the working groups were really strong in that sense. And now we have to move on to the next stage. We have to, you know, start to implement some of these recommendations.
Right. So in one of the comments that you've made in during those meetings that I really paid attention to is that, you know, it's time for white people inside the Graduate Center to step up, allies, white allies. And some of those people are well known to us. They're always stepping up. But, you know, this is a moment, a bigger moment outside of the academy walls that affects all of our student population. It affects our faculty, it affects the staff. Everyone is affected by what has happened and deeply disturbed by it. And so the process itself is, you know, I believe it's been a really, really constructive one, but who's stepping up? The question is, who's going to step up to help implement some of these ideas that we feel really strongly about that need to take place? And among our colleagues and, you know, among the faculty, I mean, they are the leaders. The faculty are leaders. They mentor and teach students, and they're everyday leaders inside the academy.
Right. Yeah. And there are many faculty at the Graduate Center that are doing amazing academic work, but they're also doing amazing public scholarship, mm-hmm. and they're also doing amazing mentoring, right? They're stepping up. And that do it almost spontaneously, you know, because
yeah, they don't think about it. They just do it. That's what
their
values are
aligned, right, with
right.
You know, moving forward. So in that way, the Graduate Center is an excellent place to kind of be positioned, because we really are on the kind of the cutting edge in terms of research and scholarship that so many of the faculty here are doing. So how do we engage others that may be less willing to step up, right? That's a question that I kind of think about or wrestle with. How do we engage? And, you know, also our graduate students. And I think sometimes they can be skeptical, right? Because, yeah, they can be very skeptical because they don't see change happening as fast as it needs to happen.
At a micro level in their day-to-day lives, right?
And it's not easy, right, to be a graduate student. And, you know, we know the funding issues, and it's New York City, and it's now COVID. And if you were adjuncting and making money, you may have lost the position, or you may be teaching way more students than you had thought you'd be teaching pre-COVID.
Right.
At this time. So,
I mean, these are real issues, particularly for doctoral students when it's a long-term commitment to get through grad school and live in an expensive city. Very difficult and very challenging. This was a particularly, though, I think in these murders that occurred against the backdrop of COVID and young people on the streets demonstrating, which was very inspirational. And, you know, I wanted to be out there, but it's too much of a risk for me. So I was like giving money as much as I could to help people organize. I think all of us were hugely affected by this. Then you throw in the arbitrary travel bans that were instituted in the early spring by the Trump administration. And you had a community is just rocked. I mean, I feel like it was every day. Of course, in my other job, I watched the news all day long. I was bracing. You brace yourself for the next event. Yeah. Horrible, horrible event. Children being thrown into detention, taken away from their parents at the borders. It was just one bad dream after another. It felt like we were all living in a nightmare. And in the middle of all this, Black Lives Matter just, you know, said, this is it. We are lives. Everything's on the line. Everything is on the line. Do you see from that period? I mean, I will say this, I've been around politics for a very long time. When I started seeing signs like racial equality in Biden events, you just didn't see that before. You haven't seen that since the 60s, really, to be honest with you. You saw it in 68, you saw more politicians talk about those who were poor, hungry. I mean, RFK was probably one of the last politicians to really talk about the poor. And now it's like a generation later, and there is a crack of light. There is a crack of light that's opened up in this moment after a terrible 4 years. What are your thoughts on that? And doing this work in that context.
Well, yeah, you put a lot there.
Sorry.
You know, so many things came together for right or wrong, right? At a specific moment in time. And the fact that, you know, we were in the middle of a pandemic and stay-at-home orders, and we saw George Floyd being murdered, lynched, however you want to describe it, on TV for eight or 10 seconds, you know, that really captured people's attention, and maybe people who in the past, it wouldn't have captured their attention, right? And
I agree. I think there's for white people,
for white people, not black, not people
of color, but for white people, there's the before Minneapolis and George Floyd, and then afterwards to see that policeman put his knee on his neck for over 9 minutes and kill him.
It
was very shocking, I think, to a lot of white people.
Whereas I saw it, and probably many other people of color saw it as part of a continuum, right? This is how Black people are treated.
Right.
From being lynched, to being brought to the U.S. as slaves, and to being lynched, to being, you know, having the police dog sicked on them. I mean, it was just kind of a continuity, and it just, this is how you were treated in this country, and often around the world, if you're a person of color or different somehow, and, you know, and it just kind of came together and people took to the streets, which is rare in this country, right? That people take to the streets.
Been a long time.
Yeah, exactly.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
In my youth, we were, that's all we did. I mean, it was the moratorium, it was racial justice, it's women's rights, it was gay rights. That was the first wave of so many movements. Yes, and it was inspiring. And I think it really began to get some traction for white Americans, not necessarily for Black. I'm sure it was inspiring to Black Americans to see so many people marching, because not all of us could march. I think it was a wake-up call for white people, especially when their children were out there marching shoulder to shoulder with other people of color. That was a turning point, I think.
You saw it at academic institutions across the country, releasing statements of solidarity and being more attuned to these things. And, you know, even the Graduate Center will release statements of solidarity, but also even released a Juneteenth announcement. And I had been at the Graduate Center for 20 years, and maybe I'm wrong, but I didn't recall the Graduate Center ever releasing a Juneteenth announcement, you know, in the past. There was a heightened awareness. You know, people talk about COVID fatigue, well, statement fatigue.
Sure.
We have to do more than just release
statements. That's just the first step. Right.
And make sure that we kind of move beyond that. Right. That doesn't become all that we're doing.
That's true. Now, what's the difference? And I'll be critical of where I teach at Columbia. CUNY said Juneteenth. The governor said Juneteenth is a holiday. We are off. The president of Columbia said Juneteenth, and we'll start observing next year. You know, I mean, it's like, That's the difference. And that's really a huge difference. It's a huge, it's cultural awareness. It's a huge difference. And so I get the best out of both places because there's an intellectual part of me that's very much uptown in my area, which is very arcane and off the beaten track. But what an amazing thing for the governor and the chancellor to stand up and say, this is it.
Yeah.
This is what we have to do.
Yeah. We have to continue doing that.
Exactly. Exactly. And in that vein, there are these difficult conversations within the academy. And you have basically been leading one in your role as a senior advisor. And I'm sure it's going to continue. I just had a conversation last week with Sadali Maleku, and who talks very articulately about these difficult conversations about the fact that the Graduate Center needs more faculty of color, and there's just not enough, and that CUNY, of all institutions, of the City University of New York, has got to do better by faculty in hiring process. What are your thoughts on that?
Sadali, is who I know quite well, is correct. You know, the Graduate Center needs more faculty of color. I mean, students want to see, it's important to see faculty who look at the front of the classroom who look like you, right?
Exactly.
So for students of color, you know, white students may have in the past have not realized that in terms of taking that for granted, right? But students of color, I think, have always wanted to see that, right? To see more faculty of color. And as well at the CUNY campuses.
Right.
There are more faculty of color at the campuses, you know, but the campuses can't be let off the hook because they have issues with retaining faculty of color. Right.
So probably maybe a higher attrition rate.
Right.
Yeah. There's that saying. There's that saying, if you can't see it, you can't be it. I've experienced that, for example, with regard to women, you know, like there wasn't any women out there. There weren't any women mentors and teachers and things like that. And of course, being gay, that's another part of identity politics, but and wanting to see it and be able to relate to it. But yes, absolutely. As she would say, a white dominated organization, it's structurally white. There's got to be change. There has to be change.
Right. Yeah, from top to bottom. Right. Because the question is, you know, when I think in terms of the scholarship at CUNY, but also often it's very kind of, when people are talking about kind of decolonizing the sciences, decolonizing the humanities, you know, kind of this Eurocentric nature of the academy. If we're going to be inclusive, I guess the question is, what are we including students of color in? Are we bringing them into this white experience?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not better.
Right.
You know, how do we bring them into a more multicultural experience or an experience where the research scholarship of color is valued?
And it's also centered in the curriculum, right? There's a centering of this in the curriculum.
I'm the executive officer of the Office of Educational Opportunity and Diversity at the Graduate Center. And we run the CUNY Pipeline Program.
Right.
Right. And that's an office that really is run. The APO, Eric Frankson, is really an important component of that, right?
He's been there for a number of years. That's a really important program, Pipeline Program.
The Pipeline Program. We've been running, and we have graduate students who serve as mentors to the pipeliners, to the undergraduates.
Right.
And for the graduate students, we've been running kind of a workshop series this semester called Decentering Whiteness.
Right.
And that's run by Richard Clark and Chris Hoffman. Those are graduate students in psychology at the Graduate Center. And that's been really useful, right? Kind of getting students aware of these notions of whiteness and decolonizing the academy.
Right.
Because these are students who are going to be getting their PhDs. If they're not teaching at the CUNY campuses or the Graduate Center, they're going to be teaching at a university campus and having to deal with these issues in terms of the curriculum and, you know, notions of whiteness.
Well, I mean, I see also experiencing the Graduate Center, this push to shape public policy. We're talking about public sociology. You're talking about urban ed. I mean, Wendy Luttrell's just doing great work over there. And leading that, you know, that discipline. And so many people like yourself and Michelle Fine are in that program too, affiliated with that program. And, you know, just so many people are actually doing scholarship, leveraging scholarship to make public policy change and change the outcomes. As somebody who's not on the faculty, I see it because it's very different in its culture and its presentation than where I teach uptown. And that is really very inspiring,
right,
at the Graduate Center. There is a commitment to the public good, teaching for the public good, whether it's teaching students or using their knowledge, creating their knowledge to shape public policy. I see it as a very forward-leaning place,
right,
in that regard.
Yeah, that's, you raise an interesting point. The work they're doing is very important, and also work out of the Public Science Project.
Yes.
Michelle Fine and Maria Torres run.
Yes.
And, you know,
yes.
And, you know, yeah, work coming out of the English department.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing about that is the fact that in many ways, the Graduate Center is a very progressive place and doing some really cutting edge leading scholarship.
Right.
But at the same time, it's a very traditional place.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
And often that is so confusing for students when they're mm-hmm. in this place that talks about just all these progressive ideals. They may be in a classroom when a faculty member or another student is either misgendering them or yes. there are microaggressions they have to deal with. And it's really kind of difficult to get one's head around that, right?
That's true.
We often set
that
the Graduate Center up.
That place be so cool.
Right.
And we so set the wonderful. And then these other things happen.
Right. So bias and racism and discrimination and homophobia.
Yes. Transphobia.
And genderphobia is yes. outside. It's outside the Graduate Center doors. When in fact, no, unfortunately,
it's
inside as well. Right. And
yes,
that's an issue for a number of students kind of trying to figure that out and navigate themselves through the Graduate Center. And especially for students of color at the Graduate Center.
Sure. Well, I'm just going to say that the Graduate Center and the students are very fortunate that we have you, Martin. We have your leadership. We have your vision because you're a person who makes a difference. I say that as somebody that didn't really know you that well at all. I just
appreciate
knew who
that.
You were. and I've gotten to know you over the last several months, and it's really been a privilege.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Are there any last thoughts that maybe now as we're less than 50 days out from the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, do you have any thoughts about America and the future?
Just for the audience, I'm Canadian.
Yes, that's, I know that. I'm
you may have
sorry.
Heard that. You
but
may have
you
heard
live
that
and
my...
work in America. You live and work in America.
For 21 years, I've
yes,
been
yes.
in America.
For better and for worse.
Right. So it's often interesting looking at this from a Canadian perspective, if I can actually still hold on to that. I don't see the current president going quietly into the night.
Right.
Right. And
no, he's dragging his ball and chain to the very end.
And what that means for the Biden administration, how difficult it will be to overcome some of the barricades that he's putting in or has put in place. I don't think it's going to be the inauguration and then things will be better. I think it's going to take time to kind of rebalance, if we ever can, some of the political norms and things that he's kind of destroyed or thrown into the
derogated.
Ditch.
Yes.
Not to get political, but by the very nature of what we do, it's political. I don't see the Republican Party. They seem to be holding on to him as well, right? I don't see.
For now, that's
yeah,
true.
For now. And, you know, and 74 million people voted for him, so that means something.
It does. But fortunately, because of New York's vote, he did not pick up as many people
right.
as he thought he would. So New York really had the last word on that vote.
And living in New York, sometimes I do feel somewhat insulated.
Oh, without a doubt. Yes.
And in this New York bubble and being at the Graduate Center, you know, adds to that. So.
But that's why we want to live in New York.
Yeah.
We choose to be here. So usually the president, you know, makes his first call after getting sworn into the Canadian Prime Minister, and let that be so for you and for us to resume the normal choreography
right.
of the American
yeah,
president and the first woman of color to serve as
yeah.
vice president. A huge representation symbol, and she is brilliant, and we're thrilled about her being in this.
Very exciting. Very exciting, right?
And listen, you have your recommendations going forward. There's a lot of support for your work and your leadership. And I just really want to thank you today for coming on to the podcast.
Tanya, thank you very much. Next time I won't avoid you.
Very good. Thanks for tuning in to The Thought Project. And thanks to our guest, Professor Martin Ruck of the Graduate Center, CUNY.
The Thought Project is brought to you with production, engineering, and technical assistance by Kevin Wolf of CUNY TV. I'm Tanya Domi. Tune in next week.